Hello everyone, welcome to week 5 of our Israel Studies seminar. We're excited to have Dr. Shlomo Fischer with us. Dr. Fischer is a senior fellow at the Jewish People Policy Institute in Jerusalem, and until his retirement, he taught sociology in the School of Education at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He has published extensively on religious Zionism and the Shas movement, and his research interests include religion in Israel and its intersection with politics and class, the American Jewish community, and the relations of religion, religious and civil education. His book, which we are celebrating here now, you can see both sides, Expressivist Religious Zionism, Modernity and the Sacred in a Nationalist Movement, was published in December 2014. Shlomo, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you very much. So I'd like to start off by thanking Professor Yaakov Yadgar and Dr. David Borobek for inviting me to give this lecture here in Oxford. It is a great privilege and honor. The subject of my talk is the mainstream of religious Zionism. By religious Zionism, I refer to a religious, ideological, and political movement that constitutes a distinct and recognizable community within the Israeli Jewish population. What in Israel is commonly referred to as a sector, migzal, right? It is estimated to comprise 10 to 14% of Israel's population. I consider anyone committed to both Orthodox Judaism and modern Jewish nationalism, that is Zionism, to be part of this religious Zionist camp. Although this sector includes numerous substreams, one can nevertheless identify a mainstream whose approaches and ideas are reflected in the educational system and sectorial media. This mainstream was historically associated with the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva and the driving force behind the settlement movement in the Golan Heights and the West Bank, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s through the Gush Emunim organization. It is estimated that about half of the roughly 500,000 Jewish settlers in the West Bank today are ideological, that is, motivated also by religious and or nationalist considerations. I say also, there are people go to the West Bank for many reasons. I emphasize, however, that my subject is not the settlers per se, but religious Zionism as a political, religious, and social movement, most of whose members reside within the 1949 armistice lines in Israel's heartland around Tel Aviv. It is currently a very prominent component of the current ultra-right government, and as I indicated, has initiated and led the settlement movement in the West Bank and other parts of the greater land of Israel. I translate Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, the greater land of Israel, right? That is the territory that was conquered in the Six-Day War, includes the West Bank, Golan Heights. It didn't include northern Sinai until the withdrawal from there. Thus, it has played a significant role in shaping the current Israel-Palestine conflict and the contemporary Middle East. So we're talking about a sector of Israeli society and Israeli polity, not the whole thing, a sector of that. And that sector, though, has had significant influence and significant impact on the situation, Israel-Arab situation, Israel-Palestine situation, and the Middle East as a whole. Okay. Let me state my central thesis at the outset. Whereas much of the academic research, especially that produced some 40 years ago, but continuing in part until today, has tended to analyze this movement as a form of fundamentalism, and in the Fundamentalism Project of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, there are a good number of articles, maybe 10 to 15 articles in the five volumes, on the Fundamentalism Project concerning settlers, religious Zionism, et cetera, et cetera, by Don Yechia, by Gidon Aran, by other people like that. Okay, I argue that it is better understood as a religious romantic nationalist movement. In other words, I argue with the fundamentalist paradigm, which had been regnant, and I propose a different paradigm. At its philosophical core stand modern notions such as self-expression and self-realization, the recovery of the free and authentic self, and the overcoming of alienation. In other words, these modern concepts figure very prominently in religious Zionist ideology, in this mainstream religious Zionist ideology and culture. Thus, a movement whose political aims appear atavistic and anti-liberal is in fact animated by profoundly modern cultural and philosophical assumptions. These premises have informed religious Zionist politics, religion, and culture for the past 50 years. I do not claim it's liberal. I do not identify modernity with liberalism. Okay, so it's not liberal, but it is modern, and it's what I call expressivist, following Charles Taylor, which I'll explain shortly. Moreover, some of the more violent and egregious aspects of religious Zionist settler behavior stem precisely from the movement's modern, not pre-modern or traditional character, right? One caveat to it, right? Following Michael Mann, I argue that because religious Zionists endorse collectivist forms of democracy and understand themselves in democratic terms, again, not liberal democracy, but they understand themselves in democratic terms, that is, as expressing the will of the people, the general will, the volonté générale, the general will, right? Their more extreme elements are particularly prone to acts of ethnic cleansing, right? And that's Michael Mann's book, The Dark Side of Democracy. Okay, we'll come back to that at the end. Okay, because of the centrality of self-expression and related concepts, I have, following Charles Taylor, termed this mainstream expressivist religious Zionism, which is, of course, is the title of my book. Okay. My research is an exercise in interpretive sociology, employing Feshtein methodology, right? The methodology of understanding the subject from within. It applies this methodology to what might be called a bad subject. Beyond granting the actors in this study full human subjectivity, something often denied them in critical or liberal sociology and in the fundamentalist paradigm, I believe that adopting this approach expands the sociological toolbox so as to better understand populations that contemporary critical sociology struggles to comprehend and explain, especially illiberal groups. One caveat, however, is necessary. I will be representing the inner world of religious Zionists viewing matters from their perspective. From that vantage point, the Palestinian issue, Israeli-Palestinian relations, appear quite differently than they do in academic discourse. Above all, among this population today, and we're talking about, right, it is not considered a moral or theological problem. The Palestinians are not considered, with a few exceptions, a moral or theological problem, but a practical security problem. Consequently, despite its impact on daily life in the West Bank, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict receives relatively little intellectual or philosophical attention, with a few exceptions. This very relegation of the issue to the background, rendering it effectively transparent, is perhaps what most infuriates Palestinians. Okay. The expressivist, The expressivist romantic character of mainstream religious Zionism can be best introduced through a brief discussion of the foundational theology of Rabbi Abraham Isaac Cook, Abraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, right, to 1865-1935, the first Ashkenazic chief rabbi of Palestine, Eretz Israel. In its overall style and configuration, though not in its specific content, Rav Cook's thought shares important affinities with the romantic and idealist philosophy of late 18th and early 19th century Europe, especially with the philosophy of Herder, Fichte, Schelling, Rousseau, and especially Hegel. I am not the first to note these resemblances, but I suggest that they stem less from the details of a shared concept or a shared idea, and more that they come from a common pattern or style of thought. It's the style of thought that makes for these affinities and not, you know, the point here or a point there. Okay, I begin with theology and philosophy, even though most people are neither theologians nor philosophers, because it is through such systems that we can grasp basic cosmological assumptions, informing the everyday behavior of ordinary individuals. As Robert Bella and his associates have shown, for instance, ordinary Americans act from markedly individualistic premises in matters of family, community, and religion, even though almost none of them have read Thomas Jefferson or have even heard of John Locke. Okay, so like Hegel's thought, Rav Kook's thought is dialectical. From his cosmology to the interpretation of contemporary events and movements such as nationalism and socialism. His dialectic draws upon the 16th century Kabbalist Isaac Luria, whom Gershom Scholem identified as a major force in modern Jewish history. I agree with Scholem completely. Okay, according to Rav Kook, the purpose of creation is to express or embody God's perfection and ideals within an identity that is not God. I'm going to do a little bit of metaphysics here. I'm sorry, I apologize, but I'm going to do a little bit of metaphysics. This occurs dialectically. In the first moment of the dialectic, God withdraws from the center of existence. That's the famous tzimtzum, Luria's tzimtzum, right? Leaving a residue, in Aramaic or in Hebrew, a reshimu, of divine substance. This residue is the metaphysical root of the profane and material world. Into this, God then radiates a beam of divine light, enabling divine ideals to be embodied in material existence. That's a summary of Rav Kook's basic cosmology of creation. Okay, through this process, God adds the dimension of becoming perfect to the static dimension of infinite perfection. Right? God is not only static, he's also dynamic. To be dynamic, he needs chisaron. He needs something to be missing in order to fulfill. Okay, so the ultimate stage, redemption, constitutes a unity of opposites. That's the famous ichud ha'afachim, a unity of that is of the divine and the material. In other words, the content of the redemption is ichud ha'afachim. Rosenack, Avinom Rosenack, put out a book with that title a couple of years ago, and that refers to the unification of the divine and the material, wherein the divine gains new vitality and breath, while the material world acquires form and refinement. The material world has what to contribute to the redemption, to the final theological, to the final eschatological state, right? To the end game. Okay, Rav Kook applies this tripartite scheme, an initial spiritual stage, a subsequent negation, and the final synthesis to contemporary developments as well, right? Famously, right, he interpreted secular Jewish nationalism in these terms. The initial stage was the exile, was the exilic, otherworldly religiosity of fear and submission. Its negation was the secular Zionist vanguard, the Chalutzim, who rejected tradition but rebuilt Jewish national life in the land of Israel. Though Rav Kook condemned their irreligion, he regarded their work as a part of spiritual renaissance, a broader and more elevated religious life. You need, even atheism was necessary to purify religion from its superstition and from its fear and submission. Okay? Secular idealists devoted to morality, truth, and human autonomy were not simply sinners, but instruments of divine renewal. In other words, secularism and modernity play a role in religious fulfillment. In this way, Rav Kook offers a theology of modernity, a theodicy of secularism. Just as Luria's dialectic explained the evil of exile, Rav Kook's theology rendered irreligion and secularism integral to the unfolding of redemption. I would put it to you this way. I wrote in the book that despite appearances, Kookist religious Zionism is a form of modern orthodoxy. Only the modernity that it relates to, let's say the modernity that I grew up modern Orthodox in the States. So I grew up modern Orthodox, and the modernity that it relates to was the modernity of the Enlightenment, the modernity of rationalism. The modernity that the Kookists relate to is the modernity of Romanticism, is the modernity of self-expression. It's a different. It's the left hand of modernity. It's not the. It's not the. It's not. It's not left hand if you play the piano. I don't play the piano, but if you play the piano, so you have the right hand that does the tune. You have the left hand that does the harmonics. So this is like the left hand of modernity. That's a wonderful simile that I know from Shalom Carmi. Okay, so anyway, slide six. Right. Okay. Now, Rav Kook, so how do you do the, so the question is, how do you, in the end, how do you do this synthesis? How do you do the unity of opposites, right? So Rav Kook articulated two complementary paths, both involving human participation towards the synthesis of the divine and the material. Okay. The amazing thing about this stuff is that all this rarefied theology actually has practical implications. That or at least so I claim. The first top-down approach proceeds from divine light perfecting the material world through history, right? The divine light moves, this is the providence, moves, the world is in constant ascent, dialectically, that means it has yiridot, it descends, it gets worse, but ultimately the overall trend is upward towards perfection. And that's the divine providence is pushing history in that fashion. The spiritual master is to identify with the devolving divine light and work with God, l'f'olim el, as an increasing awareness and implementation of the divine ideals in our material, mundane world, right? So I'll give you an example of somebody who thinks like this is Rav Yaakov Ariel, who had been the chief rabbi of Ramat Gan, a very important position, candidate for the chief rabbinate, etc. So I remember him saying to me that I am a disciple of Rav Kook, and democracy, in the sense that he meant it, we'll come to that in a second. And democracy, chelik me aliyato shel ha'olam, is part of the ascent of the world towards perfection. The movement towards democracy, which he identified with the Magna Carta, with all that stuff. There's a movement in history, and that, so somebody is moving history. It's not random. Somebody is moving history. Right? Okay. So the second bottom-up path begins with matter's innate yearning to return to its divine source. So the explanation here given is like, I don't know how to say this in English, Kelim Shluvim. The explanation is that when plumbing, that water seeks its own level, so if you pour something down, so it goes back up again, right? So that's how pipes work. That's how our plumbing systems work. So that's the way the divine influence works. If it goes down, the material world was created from God's substance, so it wants to go back. It wants to go back. Its innate tendency is to go back and become divine. How does it do that? By acquiring divine ideals, right? In the second bottom-up path begins with matter's innate yearning to return to its divine source, culminating in the recovery of one's inner authentic will. So Rav Kook is one of these people like Rousseau, like Plato, like that, who say that people actually have an innate authentic will, which has to be discovered. You don't know it immediately. You have to recover it. Okay, so then, like Rousseau, Rav Kook posed the question of how one might recover this authentic will. Answering, gave two answers, same answers as Rousseau. First, through identification with the general will of first, the collectivity of Israel, Am Yisrael, Klal Yisrael, he said, humanity, Ha'enoshut, and the cosmos. Havaya. And second, through listening to one's individual inner self in faith, morality, and creativity. Okay. Both directions embody central expressivist principles. First, that all thought, this is Herder, that all thought, in order to be fully realized, must be expressed in a material medium. What makes us human, according to Herder, is language. And thought only exists once we formulate it in language or in music or in painting or in social institutions or in something. If it's not concretized, it doesn't exist. Same thing in other words, the divine ideals only exist when they are embodied in the material world. That's an expressivist moment. Similarly, the divine ideals only reach full actualization in the mundane material world. The bottom-up path corresponds to expressivist notion that all thinking is carried out by material living beings whose true will and thoughts must be recovered, right? We do that today with therapy, yoga, etc., etc. What are we looking for? Why do we do therapy, yoga, and all that stuff? We do it because we want to know who we really are. So that notion is very much present in F. Cook and religious Zionist culture. Similarly, one must recover one's true will to return to God. Okay, these twin notions permeate religious Zionist culture. From F. Cook onward, the movement has been preoccupied with authenticity and the recovery of the true self. In recent decades, it has cultivated a keen interest in art, literature, poetry, and even sexuality as pathways to self-discovery and to God. There was an article about 2 or 3 years ago in Makor Rishon, the paper which sort of gave a review essay of all the sex manuals that were prevalent in the religious Zionist community, because that's a pathway to God. That's how you discover your authentic self. Okay, this expressivism coexists uneasily with Orthodox heteronomy, right? I mean, you know, when you grow up Orthodox, so, you know, can't do this. Why? Because the Torah says so. So, you know, there's not much room for self-expression. So how do these two things get along? So attention, Rav Cook believed, would be resolved only in the Messianic age when divine commandments would be fulfilled through one's authentic will, right? Mitzvot betelot le'atid v'lavo. There will be no commandments in the world to come. What does that mean? We will do the commandments, but we will do them not because they're commandments, but because we want to do them. Our authentic self will dictate that we do them. Yet even today, among liberal circles, the same principles underlie a certain acceptance of LGBTQ individuals, for example, that their sexuality expresses their authentic being. And that has now gained, in certain circles, a certain measure of acceptance. Okay. The expressive imperative that ideas be materially embodied also shapes religious Zionist religiosity. In contrast to Haredi sensibilities, which locates holiness in separation from the mundane. When Haredim learn, I was in the Haredi yeshiva, when Haredim learn, even if they're Israeli and they don't speak Yiddish, and they only speak Ivrit, they don't speak, when they're learning, they don't speak Ivrit, what do they speak? They speak Lashon Kodesh. They speak Lashon Kodesh, and the
express what it is.
And in other words, they speak Hebrew, but the pronunciation has been Yiddishized. The pronunciation is Yiddishized. Torah, no Torah. The pronunciation. Why? Because they want to set it apart from their everyday lives, as everyday lives, and make it into a special thing. It's removed, right? Religious Zionism, on the contrary, seeks sanctification through engagement with material reality. Hence, while Haredi rabbis refrain from ascending to Temple Mount in order to preserve its remote holiness, you can't approach it, it's too holy, that's the Haredi position. It had been once everybody's, but now it's the Haredi position. Religious Zionists include groups who actively seek to pray there, thus inflaming Muslim opposition, of course, and wish to revive ancient temple rituals such as the purification ceremony involving the red heifer. In other words, there's no religious action which is too, arcane or too this for religious Zionists to want to implement. So you have these kids, right? You know, these kids that of Kohanic families in the Old City who like can't walk around because they'll become defiled by impurity. Then they won't be able to implement the temple service, etc., etc. So that's a curiosity, but it reveals the drive is to implement as much as possible, not to remove it. Okay, now, however, the most significant impact of this metaphysical structure lies in politics. Okay, so now we get to the real thing. But before I go into the impact of expressivism on politics, I want to talk about religious Zionist politics in general, and especially its sociological aspect. So we're moving now from theology to sociology. Okay, what religious Zionism has been most famous for is the commitment to the greater land of Israel, which of course, which is adopted a maximalist and transigent position, right? This can be understood on a number of levels. The first is the sociological level, that this position arises, my argument is that this position ultimately arises from the identity dilemmas of the religious Zionist community. The major identity challenge facing religious Zionists from its inception in 1902 till today, right, is how to order or deal with the heterogeneous component of its identity, modern nationalism and Orthodox Judaism. Okay, the optimal solution that they worked out over the years is to integrate and unify these two components. How did they do that? They developed another concept. The concept, the major tool for accomplishing this is the idea of the Torah state, Medinat HaTorah. I said Torah, not Halacha, by the way. Torah, Medinat HaTorah or Mishtar HaTorah. Okay, now, the idea of the Torah state or the Torah regime, right, this included two components. Awarding nationalist activity religious value, settlement, military service, economic production, even cultural production, has religious value in religious Zionist circles, which means they expanded the nature of religious activity. It's no longer just putting on tefillin or blowing shofar, or even tefillah. It also includes going to the army, etc., right? And bringing it under religious regulation. This idea crystallized very, very slowly. First, it was applied to the local community, that is, to Moshevim and Kibbutzim. And then with the generation of the state. The generation of the state are those people who were either born or, so, more importantly, socialized after the creation of the State of Israel. And that included people, such well-known people, on the one hand, as Zvulun Hammer and people like that who took... okay, so the generation of the state insisted that the Torah state ideal, the ideal of the Torah state, be applied not only to the kibbutz. The kibbutz is relatively simple because it's the ethos of a kibbutz is mutual caring, mutual responsibility, and etc. That can fit in very well to a religious Jewish religious framework. Question is, what they wanted was to create a national program, a political national program of the Torah state, and that program would be a basis for challenging the hegemony of Mapai. That program, only perhaps along with others, would be a basis for attaining political leadership and political hegemony. This is the 1960s, not only today. This is the 1960s. Okay, so. But the question arose: what would be the content of a Torah state? How do you make the Ministry of Postal Service into a Torah thing? You know, so right. So, okay. So until the mid-1960s, there were various proposals, but they had not, and this, Yoni Garb summarized this, but you read their Alei Mishmeret, you read their publication, their organ, and it's full of a potpourri of all kinds of proposals which don't gel into anything. But, right, so they are looking for a program for a concrete political program. And here's where the Six-Day War and the greater Land of Israel comes along. The Six-Day War and the Greater Land of Israel provided the program of settling and annexing the Greater Land of Israel, Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, provided a Torah-based, concrete, detailed, coherent, practical program. Okay. And this program was also unique, right? It was not adopted by the Haredim. It was not adopted by any of the secular parties. Okay, and that's an important point, because the fact that the religious, from a sociological point of view, I'm just going to mention this briefly, the Kulturkampf, that was going on in the 1960s, and their meant that religious Zionist elites, many of them, were becoming secular and joining the secular elites in Mapai, who were in power, etc. So partly in order to offset that, this program was very valuable because it gave them a unique position in Israeli political life. Okay. Thus, not only did this become a clear, coherent program, but it becomes a clear, coherent program regarding the most important issues in Israeli political life: borders, territory, relations with the Arabs, etc. These are, in other words, so to sum up, the mainstream of religious Zionism adheres to a program of the Greater Land of Israel for the past 50 years because it solves their identity dilemma. It unifies the religious and national components of their identity. That's a very good reason, from their point of view, to continue to adhere to this, right? Okay. Now, however, they did not only adopt the idea of the greater land of Israel, they tied it to Rav Kook's metaphysical structure. So in other words, right? Thus, right, the land of Israel, Eretz Israel, this is the first, for those who are familiar, this is the first opening passage in Sefer Orot, right? That the land of Israel is an integral part of Jewish existence. It's not anything that's external to it. The land of Israel, why? Because it's seen as the concrete realization of the spiritual and the material. This is the inner meaning of what the Kookist religious Zionists take to be the religious commandment to settle and occupy the land of Israel. It has a metaphysical aspect to it, even if they're not fully articulated, right? So through it, not only sociologically can the religious Zionists unite the two components of their identity, the Jewish Orthodox and modern nationalists, that they can existentially express their true inner selves, that's their desire to return to God through implementing, right, divine ideals in the material, and identify with God's eschatological self-expression as he implements his ideals into the material world. So tying their political territorial demand to retain the territory conquered in the Six-Day War to Rav Kook's theological and eschatological higher synthesis of the material and divine lent their maximalist territorial position theological depth and enabled it to represent an entire religious nationalist outlook and way of life. In other words, they took, you know, a mundane political issue, they tied it to metaphysics, and all of a sudden, the metaphysical issue all of a sudden became very practical and concrete, and the concrete and practical thing all of a sudden became deep. Became how do you deal with the relationship between spirit and matter and divine ideals and the mundane world, etc., etc. Right? So both sides. So that was the move. The person who made this move, of course, was Rav Kook, son of Tzvi Yehuda Kook. Now, this also helps explain their intransigence. I hope this point was clear. You know, if the land is bound up with the self-expression of the Jewish people, right? The self-expression of the Jewish people is to implement divine ideals in the material world, in the kibbutz, in the state of Israel, in the material world. Then it becomes inseparable, and if the land of Israel is the embodiment of that, then it becomes inseparable from one sense of self. Political compromise thus feels like an existential violation. Their political rigidity stems not from traditionalism, again, but from philosophical modernism, from expressivism. They want to express themselves. They do that through the land of Israel. And that becomes, okay. So that's really the move that was made in right after the 67 war. Took some time to, okay. Now, these two seminal ideas, recovering one's inner self and will by identifying with the national collective and identifying with the divine spirit advancing history towards the redemption, crystallized in the mid-20th century into an entire theopolitical discourse. Rav Kook's son taught that individual Jews derived their very being from the national collective and that serving it was one of the highest ideals. That's identification with the nation. Where did this come out? It came out right now. Where did you see this? You saw this in the Iron Swords War, where religious Zionists served in combat units significantly beyond their proportion in the population. If their proportion in the population is 40%, 30 to 40% of those in combat units were religious Zionists. The army does not release figures about casualties, but it seems that they sustain again a disproportionate number of casualties without going into specifics. So this notion that serving the collective is the highest form of virtue is alive. It dictates how people behave. Remember this, okay. Similarly, he taught, based upon Kabbalistic ideas, that the Jewish state, which encompassed Jews from every class and way of life, was the divine, with the divine providence accompanying, represented the divine spirit advancing towards the redemption. So one way of looking at these two ideas is identification with the nation, And the other idea is identification with the state and its bureaucratic apparatus. You have to get used to this, that it's the bureaucratic state that they, It's the bureaucratic state that they award religious significance. Now, Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook even extended these metaphysical notions into mundane politics. Shortly after the 1967 war, he declared that the general will of the Jewish people was to retain every inch of the conquered territory, rendering any governmental attempt to relinquish it morally and legally invalid. Why? Not because the Torah says so, but because it's the will of the people. Because it's the will of the people. That's why you can't give back any right. So here he takes the metaphysical general will, mobilizes it for a mundane political issue. What do you do with the territory after that? And saying, and now, this was, of course, had a certain level of plausibility. Anybody, because in right after the 67 war, and then especially after Yom Kippur, with the demonstrations against Kissinger and the demonstrations against withdrawal, etc., you had major literary and political and cultural figures in Israel endorsing this maximalist position. Natan Alterman, Naomi Shemer, and Moshe Shamir, people very well known. So Arik Sharon. So this notion, and so according to him, the empirical general will reflected the metaphysical general will. Where did the empirical general will? Because it came out of their innate drive and their true self that they wanted to. Now, concurrently, the secular state of Israel was viewed as the earthly embodiment of divine light that devolving into the mundane world dialectically and moves it towards divine ascent and perfection. The state of Israel is thus the very vehicle of redemption and acquired intrinsic religious significance. Reb Tzvi Yehuda and the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva made Independence Day into a special religious holiday, received military leaders with the highest religious honors, and even considered voting a religious duty, donning his Sabbath clothes when he went to the polling station. Together, these two conceptions, the divine state and the general will, produced the characteristic political orientation, ethno-republican democracy. Sovereignty resides in the people, not as a collection of individuals, but as a historical ethno-religious collective whose members attain self-realization through civic virtue and service to the common good. These two conceptions also became central elements in the repertoire religious Zionists employ in moments of political crisis, particularly when the Israeli government contemplates territorial withdrawal in the context of peace agreements with neighboring Arab states or with the Palestinians. Echoing the European revolutionary tradition, knowledge of the general will by a revolutionary or vanguard elite can be invoked as justification for revolutionary action. In this framework, the claim to represent the metaphysical will, general will, has at times been used to justify extreme measures, most famously the plot to blow up the Dome of the Rock on Temple Mount. Okay, so Yehuda Etzion, who was the author of the plot, wrote three remarkable articles in the Kudah from his jail cell, laying out the theory of the revolutionary elite and the general will, can't go into that, but it's very interesting. Okay, those who emphasized Israel as a divine state, however, vehemently opposed such unilateral private violence. They argued that such acts, far from advancing redemption, in fact, retard it, because they weaken precisely that entity, the State of Israel, which functions as the instrument of redemption, its institutions, its legitimate offices, and its public life. Moreover, private acts of violence constitute a rebellion against divine providence, which in this view works with the gradual public processes of the state towards redemption, right? So most people, I don't know if everybody knows, that religious Zionism was split on every issue. I'll talk about this in a second, right? The task of religious Zionists, therefore, is not to bring about redemption by the barrel of a gun, but to cultivate a redemptive consciousness, an awareness that human actors participate in God's drama of self-actualization. These ideas shaped religious Zionist responses to political crises, from the peace with Egypt, to the gathered disengagement, to the assassination of Rabin, to the evacuation of Amon in 2006, right? Okay. However, over the past decade and a half, especially since the formation of the current ultra-right-wing government and Hamas massacre of October 7th and the ensuing Iron Swords War, fundamental changes have occurred. So this is the classic. What I've done now is analyze the classical period of Cookist religious Zionism, more or less from Sebastia, from the 1975 occupation of Samaria and the first settlements, through the disengagement in Gaza in 2005. That's 30 years of political history. Now things change. So first of all, there are transformations in religious and Zionist itself. The first major change is an internal development within Romantic religious Zionist culture itself, a shift towards the individual and the personal. During the classic period of Gush Emunim, from roughly 1970 to 1995, the ideological emphasis was on the national collective. For a variety of reasons, both internal and external, this focus gradually moved towards the individual, paralleling the rise of the economic and cultural individualism in the West during the same period. The emphasis on self-expression and self-realization, the central feature of expressivist religious Zionist culture, was increasingly applied to personal, private, and intimate spheres. This produced an efflorescence of poetry, literature, and the creative arts, a new religious interest in relationships and sexuality as arenas of spiritual fulfillment, and the theology that, much like Hasidic writings, placed the relationship between the individual God as its center. This is the Habakkuk phenomenon, Breslov, Chabad, etc., in religious Zionism. It's also led to a measure of tolerance towards untraditional gender roles, same-sex orientation, and relaxed the partial observance even within otherwise stringent or rabbinic families. Right. Okay. The influence of this shift extended, most importantly, again, into politics and in two opposing directions. In the first, physical aggression and acts of revenge became vehicles for self-realization and for communion with God. This is amazing, right? That aggression itself becomes a vehicle for self-realization, okay, and for even, as with sexuality, the fulfillment of bodily drives, including aggression, was understood as a form of self-expression. The assertion of one's being in acts of revenge was taken as a metaphor for affirming the being of God, right? Whereas the violent extremism of the Jewish undergrounds in the 1980s was linked to collective national aims and to the general will, the violent encounters between settlers and Palestinians in the fields and roads of the West Bank today bear a personal, even intimate quality absent from the earlier period. The locus classicus for this approach is Rabbi Ginsburg's defense of Baruch Goldstein's massacre of 29 Muslims in the Maratha Machpelah. That's a text from 1995. It's an amazing text. Okay, because of its grounding in self-expression and self-realization, this is modernist violence, not traditional violence, akin to that, of course, endorsed by Ernst Jünger, Franz Fanon, Sartre, and resonates with Nietzsche's will to power. As we shall see, following the October 7th attack, this tendency has evolved into a degree of ethnic cleansing. The individualist turn, however, also manifested itself in an opposite direction, through dialogue with the Palestinian other. This small but significant avant-garde development first emerged on the personal interpersonal plane. In the Gush Etzion region south of Jerusalem, settlers influenced by Rabbi Shagar and Menachem Froman began meeting and sharing meals with local Palestinians. In a manner similar to that of Kierkegaard, Barton Buber, and Gabriel Marcel, they sought self-realization through dialogue with the other. Rav Nachman here is very important. They recognize that both Israeli settlers and Palestinians are organically bound to the land of Israel, and that triumphalist fantasies of both sides that the other might simply disappear are ultimately unrealistic. Unlike the mainstream peace movement, they do not advocate separation and construction of two distinct states, but rather propose sharing the land, whether through a confederation or other arrangements. as has been pointed out, this from a practical point of view is extraordinarily difficult. But you know, they are aligned with Eretz L'Kulam, one land for all, which seeks confederation, and they are alive after October 7th. I met with Hanan Schlesinger, who's one of their spokesmen in the United States, and he said they're still alive and they're still doing stuff. All right. The most significant development of recent years, however, has occurred not within religious Zionism itself, but in Israeli society as a whole. The increasing acceptance of major elements of the religious Zionist worldview, especially its religious nationalism, that is, the sacralization of national entities and values such as the land of Israel and the state. This has been reflected in a succession of election results since 2009, with the brief exception of the 2021-22 Bennett-Lapid government, Bonagid, which have consistently produced right-wing governments. Surveys confirm the trend. 37% of Israelis now identify as right-wing, compared with only 8 to 14% as left-wing. 14% is being generous. The right-wing self-identification does not merely indicate adherence to modern nationalism. It denotes a traditionalist ethno-religious identity. Supporters of the current ultra-right religious coalition refer to themselves as the faith bloc, or simply the believers, Hamaminim. And if anybody wants to see this in live, you can watch Channel 14 as much as you want. You'll see it all day and all night on channel 14. Okay, in Israel. I don't know how you do it here. Okay.
It's accessible.
Okay. Okay. For religious Zionists, this shift in public sentiment and electoral strength has translated directly into political power. Bezalel Smotrich, leader of the Religious Zionist Party, there's a party that he adopted the name Religious Zionism. Many people are very angry at him for that, but that's a political party. It's not the community. It's not the community, right? Now serves as Minister of Finance and as a minister in the Ministry of Defense, responsible for Jewish settlers and settlements. While Itamar Ben-Gvir, head of the Jewish Power Party, which was in the same list with Smotrich, combines religious Zionism and radical populist orientations, and he's the Minister of National Security, or what used to be called the Minister of Internal Security. He's responsible for the police. Shtel Tzachfor. Anyway, okay. Yeah. Good. Religious Zionism now faces a dilemma regarding how to respond to this newfound political success. Right. Should it aspire to lead Israeli society as a whole by forming alliances with like-minded secular right-wing leaders, thereby abandoning its historic emphasis on strict Orthodox observance? Or should it consolidate its gains as a religious sectorial force, maintaining ideological purity while exerting influence over the mass right-wing Likud party? Beneath this ostensibly tactical political question lie more fundamental ideological and identity issues. Above all, the question of the higher synthesis, let's go back to Rav Kook, and the higher synthesis as formulated by Rav Kook, right? Rav Kook thought, again, that modernity and secularism and things like that had what to contribute to the redemption, right? Although few religious Zionists are versed in Rav Kook's rarefied dialectical theology, the idea of the higher synthesis has officially remained the community's overarching goal, uniting its two defining dimensions, Orthodox religiosity and Jewish nationalism. Yet the question arises, to what extent was the synthesis itself a product of constraint and circumstances? Until recently, the hegemony of secular Zionism was so powerful that some accommodation with it seemed unavoidable. Modern secular nationalism becomes kosher only when integrated into a synthesis of the Orthodox religion. But if religion now constitutes the dominant element within the new hegemony, might the higher synthesis no longer be necessary, or at least postponed indefinitely? Moreover, what is the role of the religious Zionist community within this configuration? Does it itself embody the higher synthesis by combining religion and nationalism, or is it merely one contending party within Israeli society, one that, like the Haredim, must be eventually subsumed within a broader dialectical synthesis? A related sociological question, we didn't really deal with this, but we'll deal with it now, concerns with whom religious Zionists wish to ally within Israeli society. Historically, religious Zionism has been a middle-class, even Ashkenazic phenomenon that imagined itself partnering with liberal, secular, and educated secular middle-class elites. Shalom Achshav. That was the idea with Peace Now. In political reality, however, for the past 45 years, it has consistently partnered with the populist Likud and its large lower-class base, producing not a creative synthesis of opposites between Peace Now and Gush Emunim, that was the fantasy, but a coalition of like-minded, traditionalist, ethnocentric believers, some of whom put on tefillin consistently, some of whom put it on less consistently, but it doesn't matter. Okay? Two opposing approaches have emerged in response to these dilemmas. The more open approach, represented by Naftali Bennett, sought explicitly to partner with secular elites. Right? That's why he brought in Ayelet Shaked as a secular nationalist. That was the idea. Bennett founded a joint religious-secular party and for a brief period led an anti-Netanyahu coalition government that included left-wing secular parties, Meretz, and even a moderate Palestinian Muslim party. Surprisingly, some of his supporters came from the heart of the religious Zionist religious establishment, from the West Bank settlements and the historic leadership of Gush Emunim, Eliezer Melamed, Yisrael Harel, Yoel Ben-Nun. These figures hinted that they hoped to initiate a new synthesis with secular Israelis and signaled openness to modest reforms in such areas as conversion, relations with non-Orthodox streams, and even the status of women and LGBT individuals. In stark contrast, the conservative faction insisted that religious Zionist parties retain their Orthodox character and avoid diluting their recent political gains through partnership with secular elements. This wing chose not to emphasize the higher synthesis, and some within it even denied its continuing relevance. Consequently, religious Zionism positioned itself as continuing to contend antagonistically within Israeli politics and society, devoted to advancing its sectorial and ideological interests, primarily settlement expansion in the West Bank and opposition to LGBTQ rights. The conservative wing exerted intense social pressure on the open faction through local synagogues, neighborhood networks, and children's schools. And within little more than a year, the anti-Netanyahu coalition collapsed. The open camp disintegrated, and Bennett took a recess from political life. In the 2022 elections, the hardline religious Zionist list won 14 Knesset seats, becoming the third largest party. Smotrich and Ben-Gvir assumed senior ministerial positions, gaining decisive influence over government policy. It thus appeared that the conservative wing had prevailed. Given that this faction had largely abandoned meaningful engagement with modern or secular thought and focuses instead on ethno-religious domination, the development seems to mark the end of political religious Zionism as we have known it. That is, as a movement for which the encounter with modernity was central to its identity. That's the part with, is this the end? When I put in the title, is this the end? It refers to this, right? Yet the picture is not so simple. I'm almost finished. Despite their joint electoral success, the two constituent parties of the religious Zionist list, Smotrich's Religious Zionist Party and Ben-Gvir's Jewish Power, have both declined in recent polls. Smotrich's party in particular barely crosses the electoral threshold. He appears out of step with his own constituency. As ultra-Orthodox parties have become key partners in the current right-wing coalition, Prime Minister Netanyahu has committed to legislation. This is, okay, why is it not in some bill? I'll make it short, because of the issue of Haredi exemption from the draft. Right? In other words, and that's here Smotrich has a transactional logic, which is characteristic of him, which is that he'll support the Haredim on the draft, on the Patur, on the exemption from the draft, and the Haredi parties will support him on the settlements and on the West Bank and on the annexation of the West Bank. That doesn't fly. The participation and the primal experience of fighting alongside, right? In other words, the religious Zionists have, A, contributed beyond their proportion in society to the fighting, to the combat units, and also to the casualties and to the loss. And they cannot countenance the fact that an entire sector will be now exempt from military service. This has been reflected in poll after poll. 79% are against the Haredi position. So Smotrich's transactional philosophy doesn't work, doesn't fly within his own constituency. The primal experience of fighting alongside secular Israelis in Gaza has reminded many religious Zionists that they are part of the broader Israeli public, bound by shared sacrifice, even with ideological opponents. right? They now see themselves as members of Brit HaMashartim, the League of Those Who Serve. Inevitably, this has reintroduced the question of engagement with modernity and secular society. That is, the question of the higher synthesis. Beneath the apparent political defeat of the open integrative tendency, the synthesis of the sacred and the profane seems to have gained renewed vitality. So we don't know, but I'm saying the question is still open. Okay. All of this is unfolding at a moment of profound anomie, in which Israel's civic, political, and military norms are being challenged and eroded. Beyond the devastating Gaza war, which caused tens of thousands of non-combatant deaths, the West Bank has witnessed a surge of ethnic cleansing. As Michael Mann has observed, such a phenomenon is distinctly modern, the dark side of democracy. When the people, understood as an ethno-national collective, assert sovereignty over territory, it tends to expel competing ethnic groups. Religious Zionists, with their ethno-republican orientation, have initiated and participated actively in this process. Yet, even this liminal, even chaotic moment also represents opportunity. The controversy over Haredi military exceptions raises deeper questions about the meaning and nature of citizenship in Israel. Any law mandating compulsory service for the ultra-Orthodox should apply universally, encompassing Arab citizens as well. It should make compulsory civic or national service for all, primarily in the military, but also in hospital schools, Shevet Lumi, hospital schools, and other welfare environments. Such a framework could lead to a more equal and equitable conception of Israeli citizenship. All who serve in whatever capacity would enjoy equal rights and privileges, both formally and informally. Because this conception links equality with contribution to the common good, that is, to the general will, it might even prove acceptable to some within the religious Zionists. Why, after all, should Rabbi Cook's vision of redemption not include new horizons of fairness and inclusiveness, even for Israel's Arab citizens? So to sum up, the issue of universal military service not only raises the question of the relationship of religious Zionists to the broader secular or general public and modernity, it can also raise the question of a new relationship with the Arab citizens of Israel. Thank you very much.